Welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Reisman-Ellen. I'm your host. On today's program, we're going to be talking about the impact of internet broadcasting, webcasting, and podcasting on community radio and other forms of community media. Andrew Boyle, a friend of mine, is here to talk about that, and I'm sure we'll be getting to talk about lots of other Media Geek issues. You do want to stay tuned. Andrew, thanks for joining me once again.
Happy to be Geek. I was going to say happy to be back. Happy to be in your new surroundings and back on the show.
Yeah, I mean, here in our beautiful new studios here. We're at WNUR in Evanston in Chicago, Illinois, here in the campus of Northwestern University, where the show is now originating. And I'm glad you could make it up here in Chicago, actually. Don't even have to have you on the phone.
Indeed, and it's always good to be back in Chicago. Great to be able to meet up again and to do the show live.
And what I like about this studio is that it is pretty much as loud as the as the old WEFT main studio, with the rack full of equipment whirring around behind me in the background.
If there's not a rack full of equipment directly in front of your microphone, it's not a studio, really.
No, and unfortunately, Andrew Gotthelf, who has been helping me out here, basically functioning as producer, couldn't make it here tonight. So it's my first time flying solo here at the controls here of the great WNUR, and I'm glad to be here. I'm glad you could be here, and we'll get to a lot of interesting things, as always is, when you're able to visit us. But first, I wanted to say welcome to a new station joining the Media Geek Broadcast Network. CJUM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Manitoba, which is Canada, for some of you down in the lower 48 who may not be aware of that. It's the first entree of the program on the airwaves of the Prairie Provinces.
Congratulations, and of course, welcome to the new Winnipeg listeners.
Yeah, so hello there to Winnipeg. I'm glad to have you aboard. Up to this point, Media Geek is heard only in the Maritimes. At least on the licensed FM airwaves, only heard in the Maritimes out there in New Brunswick, and in Sackville, New Brunswick, and Halifax, Nova Scotia. I also welcome KDX Internet Radio, which I guess has been carrying the show for a while, and they had sent me an email a while ago, and I kind of misplaced it, and they sent me another email. So I want to say hello to KDX Internet Radio. And that brings us up to a total of 15 licensed broadcast stations carrying Media Geek. I was a little amazed when I did the count today.
That's really good. By my count, that's probably above average for a lot of the shows that are out there being carried on community radio.
I guess, yeah. I'm mostly low power, although we have two full power stations, which is WNUR and WEFT in Champaign, Urbana, Illinois. And we also have Free Radio Olympia and Olympia, Washington, which brings us to 16 broadcast stations. They just don't have a license, and they don't need one. So welcome aboard, everyone. Thank you so much for carrying the program to all the stations who carried Media Geek, and I'm glad you're all tuning in. And I also want to call attention to another piece of news of particular importance to our friends in the Great White North. Media Democracy Day is Saturday, October 25th. So for a lot of you, it will have already happened by the time you're hearing this program. But for those of you listening to the podcast or listening here in the lower 48 or listening to the live web stream at WNUR.org, I want to call your attention to this day, which is quite a following in Canada. And I know there have been some people have tried to start the celebration here in the U.S. and in other parts of the English-speaking world, and hasn't quite caught on. But I think it's a great tradition, and it really is with a focus on independent media, media democracy, and it's different events happen all over in a lot of major cities throughout Canada.
I think it should be said that Canada has a wonderful tradition of independent and democratic media.
Mm-hmm.
AMARC, the world body of community radio stations, the Association Mondiale de Radio Communautaire, or Audio Diffuseur Radio Communautaire, were of course founded in Canada and arose in some part out of community radio activism,
mm-hmm.
Up there, as well, of course, as being influenced by things like the MacBride Commission and so on.
Yes, public service broadcasting as well. In a way, it's somewhat different from the United States, and also very different from the UK and other mm-hmm. English-speaking nations around the world.
Yeah, rather unusual in having a rather dispersed model of mm-hmm. public broadcasting, rather than the BBC being very much a monolith historically. Mm-hmm. Bush House London produces its content and sends it out to the world. The Canadians taking a different approach. In some part, I think, because of the dispersed nature of their population, the huge area that needs to be covered. So in part, it's the geographic features help influence things, but also, of course, different political climate. And they did experiment with a number of different models before settling on the model they have today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which has commercial radio, mm-hmm. much like in the United States. But a lot of community stations are connected to universities in some way, shape, or form, although it's sort of a form that I was discussing a couple of weeks ago here on the program. Often, the university is maybe attached and provides some level of funding, but the real programming is community-based, and there's certainly student interaction, but often it's primarily a community station like CKUT. Mm-hmm. In Montreal, Quebec.
Yeah, and we've talked on air in the past about the mm-hmm. Irish model. For those listeners not familiar, I'm originally from Ireland, so my original background in community radio is there. And that model was tried by a station in Ireland when we finally got community radio, but hasn't quite been able to sustain itself. So we have community radio, we have campus radio, but we don't have quite the same blend mm-hmm. that they managed to achieve up in Canada.
So I get a little bit about Canadian broadcasting there, but all in celebration of Media Democracy Day on Saturday, October 25th. Perhaps it'll catch on. We could use more media democracy, and I can't see why we can't have at least one whole day dedicated to it here in the United States. Next week on the program, I want to give a little bit of a preview. I hope we'll be talking about white spaces, which is reutilizing the spectrum, the channel space that will be vacated in February when analog television is no more. We talked some about it last week with Mitchell Shapanchik from Chicago Media Action. But analog TV is going away in February. That means there's all these channel space that is also going to become unoccupied. And recently, the FCC released a report. The engineers there released an 18-month study that shows that new technology can use white spaces without harming adjacent TV signals. One great potential application for this vacant channel space is to be able to offer wireless, true broadband internet. Could possibly be offered on a wide, inexpensive basis. And that's what a lot of folks are lobbying for, especially public interest groups. National Association of Broadcasters, not so hot on the idea. And the FCC is due to vote on the issue coming up on November 4th. So that's very soon, close to election time.
Election day.
I believe that is election day. So two very important things happening on November 4th, and it's very easy to get lost in all the election nonsense and ballyhoo, but definitely it's something we'll want to talk about more on next week's program. And so with a little bit of that errata and some and news out of the way, Andrew, you're on today because, I mean, we really want to talk about this research you're doing as part of your doctoral dissertation. Mm-hmm. You are a doctoral candidate at the Institute of Communications Research at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. You have all this experience in community radio because in addition to helping to start Flirt FM in Galway in Ireland, you're also one of the founding members of low power station WRFU in Urbana, which is also carrying the Media Geek program currently. And you're studying now the relationship and the effects of the internet, specifically podcasting, webcasting, on community radio.
Exactly. And this is something, as you say, that I come to in part because of my experience doing community radio, and to a large extent, I suppose, it's that background that brought me to becoming a grad student in the area, interested in just how do these organizations work, and in terms of the sort of questions that I tend to look at in my research more generally, I'm interested in technology, political policy and regulation, and kind of the social structures that we put in place that regulate engagement, and then thirdly, public engagement with politics broadly spoken, and so that brings me, you know, that brings in community radio, but also then over the last, I suppose, half decade or decade, as I've been, you know, running my own website, doing community radio, but also seeing the emergence of this thing called podcasting, you know, listening to some webcasts and so on, I start thinking about what impact is this going to have on radio?
Mm-hmm.
And more particularly, what's it going to have on community radio stations? So community radio stations, as many of the listeners to this show will know, in particular if you're listening to it on a community station, tend to have very much a local feel. They'll have a couple of syndicated shows, quite often something like Democracy Now or the like, in order to pad out their public affairs content. But then it'll often be volunteer-driven, locally oriented programming, and something that tries to provide an alternative to mainstream media and indeed commercial radio. And it seems to me that webcasting and podcasting provide both a number of opportunities to community radio, but also challenges and indeed, in certain respects, dangers. So, for instance, a show like Media Geek is able to be easily syndicated outbound. If you go back, if you go back 30 years,
mm-hmm.
National Federation Community Broadcasters is founded in or around the mid-1970s. And sometime in the late 1970s, they decide to set up a syndication service
mm-hmm.
based out of Champaign, Illinois. And what they do is they record shows generally onto large quarter-inch reel tapes, and they mail them to stations.
It was called bicycling.
And it's a really cheap way to get content from one to the other.
Mm-hmm. And indeed, I mean, that's how any syndicated programming, even on commercial radio, that didn't need to be up to the minute and super timely,
mm-hmm.
was distributed in the same way. For instance, Casey Kasem's weekly Top 40 was distributed actually on vinyl records because there were several hundred stations, and it was cheaper to stamp records and send them out each week. Rather than having to, record these tapes in real time, but that's still kind of cost prohibitive for the non-commercial community stations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is, you know, going back some time, this is the sort of thing, as you say, bicycling tapes and bicycling shows, station to station. So what a station would do is they'd receive a show, they'd play it, they might send it on to the next station, or they might record over it and send it back to the station that it had come from. And so from that time, late 1970s, stations are trying to create interconnections between each other. Somebody might have an interview with a Noam Chomsky or a Howard Zinn or, you know, some prominent figure in alternative or radical politics who, you know, listeners are not going to hear on other stations. And so this is part of the raison d'etre of many stations, is to bring voices that won't otherwise be heard. And so, you know, if somebody gets an interview with Noam Chomsky, they think, well, maybe somebody else might like to play this too. And so rather than just, you know, have it go off into the ether, let's pass it on and so on. And stations also, the Pacifica network, make use later in the 1980s and onwards of satellite feeds.
Right.
And so this is another means by which people do it. But satellite, you know, tape bicycling is slow. Satellite is instantaneous or near instantaneous, but it's expensive.
And it's utterly synchronous.
Yes.
Meaning if there's a program you'd like to carry on your station, but it comes off, you know, it's broadcast on the satellite at 8 p.m., you need to record it.
Yeah.
And then play it later, which requires additional overhead and labor, you know, before computer automation, mm-hmm. you know, happened in really the late 90s. It all had to be done manually.
And community radio, so often, so much of the labor, and often all of the labor, being volunteer based.
Right, right.
So you need somebody, and volunteers are wonderful. I'm an advocate of access and participation, but one of the things that happens when you're dealing with volunteer labor is because people are volunteering their time, they get sick, something mm-hmm. comes up,
right?
Their kid gets sick, and so they, you know,
or their work shift changes, exactly. or something like that. Yeah,
and so you don't have the reliability week to week for that. And so podcasting, in terms of a way for stations to access content, really changes the economics and changes the dynamics. So a large part of what I'm looking at is the way in which stations are experimenting both with internet delivery, and so NPR and the Pacifica Network now both offer internet-based delivery of their programming. With NPR, it's their Content Depot system. With Pacifica, they've got AudioPort, and so you can go online, download it, just like somebody downloads a YouTube video, and play it back on your station. And also, of course, something like MediaGeek. Somebody goes to your website, MediaGeek.org, downloads the show, and listens to it at their leisure. Or a station can download the show and play it back on air. And so there's opportunities there. But also then there's challenges for stations where, and I know this is something we came across at RFU, where many of our activists and volunteers were saying, well, it's possible to do webcasting. It's possible to do podcasting. So we should.
Mm-hmm.
And there seems to be, to me, to be, there's an extra layer of debate mm-hmm. that needs to go on. And I talked with, say, people at WORT in Madison, where they talked about the sort of debate that they had about, well, so if we put it on air, on the one hand, it means that so somebody who's working in a basement somewhere in Madison is going to be able to receive the station over the net where they would never have been able to receive it before. But it also changes the dynamics insofar as people in New York are able to hear the station.
Mm-hmm.
And there can be a tendency for somebody who's producing a show to aim perhaps at the larger audience or the broader audience, and so avoid their, you know, local references or continuity of local stories, and instead have the focus of a station or the focus of a show move from what might previously have been very much focused on the local community, and now focused you lose a little bit of definition. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, a change of that focus. And so for some stations, that's not going to be a negative. For some shows, that's not going to be so much of an issue. So MediaGeek, even before it you know, it becomes a podcast available, a lot of the issues you're dealing with are not just out of the Champaign-Urbana community. You're dealing with issues of media policy and structure.
Although I'll admit mm-hmm. that I think that I paid a little closer attention. The show used to be on in Champaign-Urbana, that's mm-hmm. where it started before WNUR here in Evanston. I think I did pay a little attention. And there were at least a couple programs before the first station picked up where we did a couple of highlights on local media ownership. And it's like and especially in a place like Champaign-Urbana, even more so than a larger metropolitan area like Chicago, people make certain assumptions that their local media are local. Even with the clear channelization, mm-hmm. some groups are better at appearing local than others, going so far as to even like incorporate, have a local LLC or something, or a local holding company, even though they're affiliated with a more national company. And we went through and said, okay, who owns this? And let's draw out this connection. Did you know that the newspaper owns, you know, two of the top-rated stations in town? Did you know this? Did you know this? And pull that out. Which I still think is an interesting exercise, but less specifically interesting to a national audience. Mm-hmm. And it's not something which I continued once we reached a certain critical mass of stations. So I can reflect to myself that, yes, in producing the program, I have that in my mind of, I think that in a way, you know, these local issues can stand in for bigger ones. And so I talk to people in Champaign-Urbana, such as a person providing a certain type of wireless internet service is pretty innovative, because I felt it was just interesting altogether and yet very local to Champaign-Urbana. But I'm still always keeping that in my head that I'm still serving a broader, you know, North American audience and not wanting to get too specific.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so that gives, you know, a very practical set of examples then of that set of challenges that individual producers, individual volunteers, if they're thoughtful, must address and think about, and also that stations find themselves addressing. So one set of questions I'm interested in is this notion of how will community stations respond to these new technologies?
The local becoming global.
And both in terms of taking them in and sending them out, what are the strategies that stations mm-hmm. say, how do we adapt? How do we integrate? What other sort of pressures do we want to take into effect and kind of do a little bit of pushback on? And so that's one whole set of issues. Another set of issues that I'm interested in is there are a lot of content producers out there. I think I looked at a cross section of community stations in the United States, about 10% of those who call themselves community stations. And they carry between some, like, you know, 30, 40 stations, they carry something in the range of 130 different syndicated programs.
Really? That yes. many? Wow.
Now, so they kind of break up into groups. Of the stations I looked at, most of them carried Democracy Now!
Which, for people who may not realize, because it's carried a little less widely in Chicago.
Yes.
It's a daily one-hour radio and television program. I think you can see it on CAN TV, Chicago Access Network here, but a TV version in Chicago on cable. Hosted by Amy Goodman, who is an award-winning journalist.
Yes.
And is you know, sort of the progressive McNeil Lehrer report, for lack of any better way of putting it, and is probably the most widely syndicated at this point community radio program. It also shows up on public access television and even on some public stations.
And Democracy Now! Kind of is really the most successful.
Yes.
They started out in WBAI, a community radio station out of New York, one of the five Pacifica owned stations. So I talked earlier about Pacifica as a syndication network, but Pacifica themselves own and operate five stations: KPFA, the original in Berkeley, California, WBAI, and a number of other stations around the country. Now, Democracy Now, as you say, they actually, due to some of the interminable, political infighting that happened in Pacifica in the late 1990s, they're actually produced somewhat independently now, but they are, their primary affiliation is with WBAI. They produce outside the station but have a contract with them to produce the show. And they produce this one-hour show, and they've made huge use both of Pacifica's syndication network, but also of their own distribution efforts. So they podcast their show on the net. They have videos of the show.
A TV version of it now.
TV versions also available through podcast online. The audio and video are both available by satellite, so you can take it on your public access, your community stations. And I think it's several hundred outlets now worldwide that pick them up. and that's also counting. So WRFU, so in Urbana-Champaign, which is slightly unusual as an outlet, but to give the kind of spread that Democracy Now have, WEFT, the full power community station, broadcasts them on delay in the afternoon, so they're 1 hour audio. Our local public access channel puts them out as a video feed. They take the video, again, a 1 hour version, and WRFU takes a 10 minute version of their, so there's new news headlines at the top of the hour, and I think it's a volunteer project that translates those news headlines into Democracy Now in Espanol, and so we carry that, and so that's, you know, they've really made use of using the net to make all these different versions available, as well as the more traditional satellite and so on. So lots of stations take that, but there's a huge range of shows, and then there's a few like NPR shows which are picked up. There are some community stations that are also NPR affiliates, and so they take some of the usual suspects.
You know, I actually want to quickly redirect you to something that we were talking about off air before we came in, and that you noted, you know, in terms of the debate of the stations going online in terms of being able to webcast, and you put it very succinctly there's sort of a policy issue embedded in there, for lack of a better way of putting it, in the choice to be online either in addition to broadcasted to the same feed or doing additional things online.
This is early on our discussion about kind of the different sort of policy environment.
When you put it very succinctly, and I really wanted you to share that real quickly in the time we have left here.
Essentially, radio stations are subject to FCC regulation. That means no cuss words before 10 p.m., often later. And that is, you know, federal regulations of radio and television, because it's broadcast airwaves, of your content, and generally, as I say, obscenity and decency are what's covered. Online, if you're producing a podcast, no FCC regulation. However, what you have instead is that copyright restrictions are far more stringent than they are for radio. Radio has a couple of buys on copyright because it's seen as a promotional venue for content, whereas podcasts aren't treated in the same way.
Nor is webcasting.
And it's treated instead as a product that needs to be taxed by the content production industry. And also net neutrality, which is an issue that I know you cover regularly on your show, is something that becomes another constraining factor. So what's happening is that stations are swapping one set of regulations, which is designed for broadcast, for a kind of a more inchoate set of regulations, copyright, net neutrality, and so on, which together serve to create a series of constraints for stations.
Right. And what people don't realize is that a webcasting station has to pay royalties to the recording industry for the songs they play online. And commercial stations, or at least non-affiliated sort of non-commercial stations like a community station, have to pay quite a bit. And then on a podcast, you really cannot, which is downloaded by its very nature, shareable and copyable by its very nature, without permission of the copyright holder for the music you play, you can't distribute your podcast full of other people's music. Whereas here, any broadcast station, we can sort of freely play songs as we like without having to pay a cent of royalties back to recording industry, although most stations have an agreement with ASCAP and BMI to pay some kind of royalty back to the songwriters. And this is a longstanding agreement going way back to the birth of broadcasting.
And the differentiation there, the exception for the recording industry, because it's seen that by playing their version, the band's version or the artist's version of the song over the air, you're prompting sales of that disc.
Andrew, thank you so much. This is Media Geek, and we bring it to a close. I'll be back in one more week with more news and views of our media environment. In the meantime, check out Media Geek online at mediageek.net. And the radio show is at radio.mediageek.net. You can download it, subscribe to the podcast, or listen right in your browser. If you have any comments about the program, please send them to me, Paul@mediageek.net. Thanks so much for tuning in.